Okay, I call the Transportation Committee to order, and we'll start out by opening a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3014. Okay, we got Keith Levitt and Barbara Jacobson. Okay. And as they're coming up, I'll get Janet to tell us about the bill, and this is Representative Greenlick's bill, so we'll...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3014 is sponsored by Representative Greenlick at the request of the Port of Portland, and it would allow the sale of real property by the Port of Portland to be governed by federal law and Oregon statute governing ports. There are statutes governing the sale of land by ports, and those conflict with some other statutes and with federal rules regarding sale of land and what can be done with the proceeds from the sale of real property. So the port is here to talk about those changes and what the conflict is, and a pretty simple bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Representative Greenlick?
I may stay here, sir. As you know, the port... is my constituent with its headquarters in my district, and I'm I was very happy to introduce this at their behalf. We have Keith here with us today, and he's assured me that he's not going to screw it up. I will defer to the board on the substance of this bill.
Good morning. Go ahead, Keith.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Keith Levitt with Port of Portland. And the reason I can assure Representative Greenlick that I'm not going to screw up is because I brought Robert Jacobson with me from the port, who is our legal counsel out at Portland International Airport, and Barbara will go ahead and explain the bill.
Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barbara Jacobson. Thank you very much, Representative Greenlick, for sponsoring this for us, and thank you for letting me testify today. I think the summary already given is a pretty good one. This bill, in my mind, is really cleaning up a technical error that we didn't realize was even existed until last summer when the Boy Scouts of America Sea Scouts Division approached us about purchasing a little strip of surplus property that they've been leasing from us for a number of years. Just as a way of background, the Port of Portland owns four airports. Portland International Airport, of course, is the most famous of our airports, but we also own Hillsborough, the second largest in the state, Troutdale, and the, believe it or not, Molino Airport. And all of those airports were basically developed and continue to be operated and maintained in large part using federal grant monies. Our grant assurances, as well as FAA regulations and our airport operating certificates, require us to comply with the grant assurances attached to those monies. And one of the grant assurances has specific regulations on how we dispose of surplus property. That grant assurance requires that we do a fair market value analysis using appraisals, that it be marketed to the public for fair market value, and that once sold, the proceeds of the sale be either returned to the United States government or, with the approval of the government, reinvested in another airport project. We're specifically prohibited from mixing airport funds with the port's general funds. The legislation that we're asking to amend addresses the sale of surplus property by all municipalities who own airports, and we're included in that definition. Unfortunately, the sale procedure set forth in the statute didn't contemplate our situation and basically requires the airports to follow a county sheriff's sale process and then deposit the money with the general fund. That, of course, is in direct conflict with our grant assurance. So what we're asking this committee to move forward for us is the amendment to the bill, which allows us to follow federal regulations and requirements, as well as our own statutory provisions pertaining to the port's ability to sell and acquire property. Any questions?
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair, any chance someone will try to outbid the Boy Scouts, or
Have your thoughts?
No, I don't think so. The Boy Scouts have operated or have been on this property for about 20 years. It's a little strip along the Columbia River. That's why it's the Sea Scouts Division. It's a great use for us because it has doesn't conflict. There's not going to be anybody that will complain about airport noise. They've been there. And so we have not had any other interest. And the FAA is okay with the sale to this group as long as there's navigation easements. So this will allow us to move forward. Right now we're on a short-term lease with them.
Thank you, Mr. Any other questions? Certainly, Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was going to point out to the committee that a discussion with Ann Crook at the Department of Aviation indicated that this is a could be a problem for other airports and other municipalities if they are sell airport land and there's federal money involved. But because of the narrowness of the relating clause, real property sales by the Port of Portland, other airports couldn't be changed at this point. She says it's not a particularly urgent issue, so they may try to get legislation next session to apply to other airports and ports.
Make it broader than what it is.
Yeah, if I could add to that, when we worked with the Boy Scouts this summer, we didn't even realize this conflict existed, and we contacted Ann at that time. It's very rare that airports have surplus property to sell. This is kind of a unique case, but it's good to start the ball rolling on getting the conflict fixed.
Any other questions? Looks like it's no questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 3014.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3014 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Beyer moves House Bill 3014 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Can we put it on a consent calendar?
Mr.
Chair, I move we put it on the... Oh.
Go ahead.
I move we put whatever that number was on the consent calendar, 3014.
Representative Zahner moves that House Bill 3014 be placed on the consent calendar. Is any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2768. Yeah, Floyd just came out. And Representative Posansky, please. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. If it's all right with the with yourself and the committee, I'd like to have Karen Frost.
Certainly.
Also here as an advocate for the bill.
Janet, you. Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2768 would allow bicycle operators to proceed through stop signs and flashing red light signals, not through solid stop light, but through either a stop sign or a flashing red light, if they do so at a safe speed and they yield right-of-way to traffic and pedestrians that are lawfully within the intersection or approaching the intersection. It creates the offense of improper entry into an intersection controlled by a stop sign or and a flashing red light, and classifies the offenses as Class D traffic violations punishable by a maximum fine of $75. Under current law, failure to obey a traffic control device, including a stop sign flashing red light, is a Class B traffic violation punishable by a fine of $300. So that's what the House Bill 2768 is exempting bicycles under certain conditions from that violation. Mr. Chair, we put at your place, and the witnesses may testify, too, that there is an Idaho statute currently that allows operators to proceed at a safe speed through stop signs and steady red signals in Idaho, but this bill does not allow proceeding through steady red signals. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Representative Posansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. Thanks to your staff for laying out really the provisions of the bill. This bill, House Bill 2768, for the record, it's Floyd Przonski, House District 8, serving parts of Eugene as well as southwest central Lane County. House Bill 2768 will, in fact, would permit individuals who are operating bicycles in the course of using due diligence to be able to proceed through a stop sign or a flashing red light and treat those as yield signs. Basically, what this will do is will keep an individual from having to come to a complete stop. As staff has stated, there is actually previous legislation that's actually enacted in Idaho that does, in fact, not only allow for a bicyclist to do that, it also would does, in fact, allow them to actually go through a traffic control device, i.e. a red light, using the same due course that's required for going through a stop sign. The purpose for this is really twofold. If you're familiar with the how bicycles operate and the use of the pedals, what we have seen in more recent time is a shift and change in the type of pedals that are used on mini bikes. Instead of having the straight flat pedal that we may have be more familiar with from the days when we rode bicycles as children, currently, there are bicycles that use toe clips as well as what's known as step-in pedals. I'm a very avid cyclist, do thousands of miles a year, and I can attest that those type of items are very efficient and also are very safe because you do not lose your footing off the pedal. But when you come to a stop sign, and when you're required, as the current law does require, to come to a full stop, you have to disengage from the pedal, and then it's an, there's an issue of getting, let's say, reattached to the pedal or somehow strapped back into the pedal when you take off. The bill is very specific in making certain that we hold people accountable for the abuse of this type of system. Anyone who is operating a bicycle in these situations are in fact going to be required to use due diligence and enter a intersection with the understanding that they have to yield right away to both vehicles as well as pedestrians. Basically, when a bicyclist is approaching one of these intersections, instead of going through the procedures that we require currently for bicycles as well as for motor vehicles, they will see the stop sign as a yield sign. Clearly, if they fail to yield the right-of-way to a vehicle that has the right-of-way or a pedestrian who's in the walkway, they will be in violation of the statute and can and should be cited. The other reason we feel that this is appropriate for bicycles as compared to if someone wanted to know, well, why shouldn't we just allow this for vehicles? When you're on a bicycle, you have much more sense of your awareness of what's going on around you because you're not within an enclosed vehicle. You are traveling much slower speed than most vehicles would, and your vision is much better because you can, in fact, see and hear and respond much quicker than you can in a vehicle. I'm going to stop at this point and ask Karen Frost to introduce herself and give her comments for an organization that she's appearing on behalf of.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Brown and members of the committee. My name is Karen Frost, and I'm the program director of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance is a nonprofit organization statewide in Oregon. We create safe and sustainable communities by making bicycling safe, efficient, and accessible. The primary goal of the BTA is to improve the safety for cyclists in order to encourage more people to ride bicycles and to reap the benefits of bicycling. Personally and societal benefits are great for bicycling. The BTA is totally committed to having bicyclists ride as part of traffic and to obey all of the rules and regulations. The BTA is also interested in helping develop laws that govern bicyclists so that they can operate safe and efficiently on their bicycles in the transportation system. The BTA is also a member of the Oregon Transportation Safety Coalition, whose goal is to increase the safety for all road users, bicyclists, pedestrians, auto occupants, and youth drivers. VTA supports House Bill 2768 because it makes bicycling easy, safe, and more attractive for all the people in Oregon. House Bill 2768 allows bicyclists to recognize signs, stop signs, as yield signs, requiring them to yield the right-of-way but not have to come to a 0 mile per hour stop. Many urban and rural, urban and suburban streets have intersections that do not have traffic control devices, but people understand the yield procedures set out by the law. And then some streets have an intersection with two stop signs in order to determine who yields the right-of-way and to slow traffic of fast-moving cars. Of course, on faster on roads that have higher volumes, there are four stop signs for cars, once again to clarify who has the right of way and also to make sure that the streets are safe because of fast moving vehicles. Under this bill, the bicyclist would yield the right of way in all of these intersections if the vehicle code requires that bicyclist to do that, and take due care passing through the intersection so as not to endanger pedestrians or children, small dogs, and the elderly. And the bill allows the bicyclist to move through without coming to a 0 mile per hour stop. The bill recognizes the intended use of stop signs as traffic control devices, protecting pedestrians and other vehicle users from high-speed automobile potential crashes. And the bill also recognizes that bicycles move slowly, pose little or no danger to pedestrians in neighborhoods. They can stop quickly at slow speeds and are not the vehicles that warrant the traffic control devices as cars are. And bicyclists benefit greatly from continuous movement, even when it's slow. So because of the force that's required to stop a bicycle and then start it up again. I'd like to give you an example where traffic engineers actually recognize the uniqueness of the bicycle as compared to cars. In neighborhood streets, there are some that are designed to attract bicyclists. They allow them to travel smoothly through the streets without obstructions. They're called bicycle boulevards. This is the planner's parlance for that type of facility. And the facility recognizes that bicyclists are frustrated by having to stop and start every other intersection. A key principle in this design of the bicycle boulevard is to locate fewer stop signs along the street so that the bicyclists can flow easily without having to stop. And the second principle is that there are traffic control devices on this facility that slow cars. So there are traffic circles or humps or diversions that impede the speed of cars and may even force a car to divert, but it lets a bicycle go through. The third principle is that the bicyclists do not impose a threat to children and pedestrians. Therefore, having unimpeded traffic by bicycles through neighborhoods is not a safety hazard for children and pedestrians. So these principles recognized by traffic engineers are key to House Bill 2768. And as stated earlier, there is a similar bill in Idaho that is well-received and does attract bicyclists and has not created any increase in crashes. House Bill 2768 has received a great deal of attention from bicycle planners and cyclists who are part of the BTA network, and there's been overwhelming support for these concepts. The bill aligns the law with what cyclists are currently doing now, not because bicyclists are scofflaws, but because they're frustrated by the laws of physics. And still, the bill maintains the safety and right-of-way provisions necessary to protect the road users. Thank you very much. I appreciate this opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you, Karen. Representative Prozanski, I have Senator Metzger here to testify on the next bill.
Okay.
Would it be all right? I don't know what your time restraints are, but it would be all right to open the hearing on the next bill and get his testimony and then move back to questions on yours?
Mr. Chair, that would be fine.
Okay. Thank you. We'll recess the public hearing on 2768 and open the hearing on House Bill 3001. Senator Metzger, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Janet, can you give us a quick rundown on what this bill does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill would extend to January 1st, 2008, the sunset on the requirement that ODOT select two safety corridors as pilots for doubling traffic violation fines. The original bill from 1999 required the department to select two corridors. They did that. The two corridors are US 26 between Sandy and Government Camp and Highway 18 from Bellevue to Grand Ronde. Those have been posted for double the base fine for most traffic violations. And the bill that legislation was extended by the 2001 legislature for two additional years, but that time period is up at the end of this year. What House Bill 3001 would do would be to extend that beyond for another 4 years. The language in the legislation, the original legislation, allows ODOT to pick two corridors, so ODOT, under the extension of the deadline, would be able to stick with the two corridors they have. These are pilots. Or pick two additional corridors, keep one of the corridors and pick an additional, but the limit would be two corridors for doubling the fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only other thing is that the Legislative Council recommended an emergency clause because of a date change, so that's the amendment we have. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you. And I'll be brief. I know Troy Costales from the Department of Transportation will testify on this bill. The House Bill 3001 is an important one for my constituents on Highway 26 up at Mount Hood. I think many of you are familiar with that. That and Highway 22 have the dubious distinctions of two of the most dangerous highways in the state, and people still like to fly off that mountain as if they're invulnerable. And this has been Mount Hood Traffic Safety Committee was instrumental in working on this back in 1999, and Sergeant Hastings of the Oregon State Police, who patrols that area, is very supportive of this and the effects that it has had in their enforcement in that corridor. You might also be aware, if you've been up to the mountain lately, there's major work going on now in widening Highway 26 between Zigzag and Rhododendron, so it's even more hazardous. And being able to have some more teeth in the law there, where the traffic does go down to 45, and a lot of people still think they should be going 75 up there. And we regularly have fatalities there on a regular basis. But it's been getting better. And both the Mount Hood the Traffic Safety Committee and the Oregon State Police cite this as one of the tools that has helped them try to bring down the death toll on Highway 26 at Mount Hood. As Janet mentioned, the original legislation was in 1999. It basically wasn't effective the first 2 years because the way it was written, the courts were not enforcing the double fines. And we made a technical change in the 2001 legislature so that actually they would actually be able to use this. So effectively, we've really only had the double fine being effective for the last year and a half. And we feel by going to 2008, we'll have a good book of information, you know, for future decision makings after that time. We'll have a good 5 years of research and history to see whether or not this has been a good tool that we would want to use elsewhere in the state or not. I would appreciate positive consideration of allowing ODOT to continue to this experiment, and I'm certainly hopeful that they'll want to continue at least one of those on Highway 26. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? Looks like you got off easy.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3001 and reopen Public hearing on 2768, and again asked the representative for Zansky and Karen Frost to come forward.
Mr. Chair, thank you. If I could just make a couple of closing remarks before we take questions. I just wanted to, I guess, emphasize a few points. And developing this law or this bill for consideration, I took in consideration concerns of bicyclists as well as law enforcement as to the issues that we needed to face. We looked at the Idaho law, and as has been mentioned, it is much broader as to what it allows an individual to do. We felt that it was at least as a first step that we should only go so far, and that's why we're only limiting this bill to stop signs as well as what would be red flashing lights, which would be equivalent to a stop sign. As it has been mentioned, and I know I've my discussions with other members of this committee and throughout the building who do cycle, current practice by many individuals is not to come to a 0 miles per hour stop at these type of intersections because of the potential safety issue and the inconvenience of being forced to do this break in your travel. But they do yield before they actually enter because they realize the risk they have to themselves as to others. The reason for the reduction in the penalty, the request of dropping it from a Class B violation to a Class D violation, we believe there should be a distinction between the risk of a motor vehicle going through one of these type of traffic control intersections as compared to a bicyclist, and that's the reason we have asked for that modification as well. We're here to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Mabry.
As you can obviously see by looking at my body, I don't cycle thousands of miles a year. But I do have a little scooter, and I enjoy riding it from time to time. I'm not sure I can phrase a question, but I would like you to address my concerns, and that is a couple of things. One, it's inconvenient for the cyclist to stop. I know and understand that, but it's also harder for me driving an automobile to see a cyclist than it would be an automobile. And so I have to be concerned for the driver of the car as well. Then I think in terms of my grandchildren, and they see you approach a traffic signal and look both ways and go through, and the next traffic light they come to, they say, well, Representative Przanski didn't stop, here I go, and they barrel through that without knowing. It's difficult for me to think, you know, how that practice relates to traffic safety for my grandchildren. And then thirdly, because I do ride a scooter, I can see that the next group coming down the pike is what about us? What about motorcyclists? What about scooter drivers? And so can you just kind of generally address those concerns?
I'll do my best, Mr. Chair and Representative Mabry. My answers to those three questions would be as follows. Yes, there is an inconvenience, but there's also an efficiency of the use of the bicycle for commuting. Many individuals that I know BTA comes involved with not only include commuters but also children. I'm going to let Karen explain some of that as to the programs they have, but I think it's something to recognize. The other part is really the design of the pedals and how the system is now set up. I can tell you I have had what I call the Artie Johnson theatrics of where I've gone up to an intersection and I've not been able to actually unlock my pedal. And basically, as the old tricycle, just fall over on the side. Very embarrassing, and also a very real traffic risk as to the direction you fall, as well as the risk to the individual that's making contact with the concrete at that point. BTA, and one of the reasons I solicited their advice and consult on this bill, because I wanted to make certain it was something that we felt that was going to be appropriate for Oregon, knowing that Idaho already has an existing law that's even broader. And at first I actually looked at whether we should include full traffic control devices in this. We felt the confusion would be too great. We do believe that through the programs, and one of the individuals who actually provides the education services for youth in Eugene area for BTA, he and I discussed this recently, and he felt that this is something that could, in fact, be adopted into the training of young cyclists. What we have to realize is that we all have duties and responsibilities. This is not going to relieve an individual of the obligation to make sure the right-of-way is clear and that they do, in fact, still have the duty to stop when it's not. Clearly, you're going to have individuals in vehicles as well as on bicycles who unfortunately will not obey the law. That is why I, as a prosecutor, have the opportunity to try to hold those individuals accountable when law enforcement is able to cite them. And that's basically what we need to be able to get across. Lastly, regarding the expansion of this into other areas, I'm not saying it won't happen in the sense of someone asking you to do that, but again, I believe that when you look at the differences in a human-powered vehicle, and under the current vehicle code, bicycles are defined as vehicles. They're not motored vehicles, and clearly there can be a distinction and should be a distinction between the two.
Well, I would like to address the question about children and how are we going to educate children. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance has, for the last 5 years, we're going into our fifth year, a bicycle safety education program. We have bicycle safety education programs in 15 communities around the state, from Ashland to Bend to Portland and down the Willamette Valley. Our main purpose is to teach children, and these are middle school children, so they have the abilities, the cognitive skills, to really be out on their own. We would like children to feel that independence again that we had when we were children, because it was a different time perhaps, but now it's even more important because of health issues and community issues that children are on bicycles and walking. And our, of course, main concern is teaching them the rules of the road and safe handling, bicycle handling skills so that they are competent riders. I believe it's to teach that there's a difference in the law that bicyclists treat stop signs as yield signs is just a matter of education for everyone, and it can be easily addressed. And once those kids get on their bikes, they also understand the irrationality of bringing their bodies to a complete stop. I mean, there are even police officers who understand incorrectly that a bicyclist is supposed to put her foot down, which is not at all written in the law. So we need to educate law enforcement officers as well about the law. And this would allow then the logical motion of bicycles, and law enforcement officers would not have to be concerned about whether they're going to cite a bicyclist for just taking due care, going through an intersection, and yet not having to come to a complete stop.
Thank you.
Representative Greenway.
Thank you, sir. As is Representative Mabry, I have a concern, I guess, rather than a question, or so maybe it would help you. I was sitting at an intersection, I think Saturday, downtown Portland, at a red light, and a bicyclist zoomed by me on the right, through the red light, into the intersection, made a left turn, saw traffic ahead of them, jumped up onto the curb, and proceeded along on the sidewalk. Now, I know that's at least three illegal things. I'm sure of that. But the issue has to do with the question of relationships between a motorist and a bicycle. And it got me really thinking about what is a motorist in this case, and I'm not a bicyclist, although I support bicycling in every way I can. What's a motorist supposed to think a bicyclist, a motorist is supposed to relate to that vehicle? Is it a vehicle that has all the rights of the road? I drive on Northwest Skyline and there'll be a bike in the middle of the road, and the bike mostly won't try and yield to me. It's possessing its rights as a vehicle to be down in the middle of a lane, and I respect that, and I stay carefully behind them until I can carefully pass. Say, okay, it's a vehicle. And then I'm waiting in an intersection and saying, well, it isn't exactly a vehicle because it's not a motor vehicle, and bicyclists don't like to exert any extra energy it takes to stop and start again. I hear you saying, but then how am I and other motorists supposed to relate to this vehicle as a vehicle? It's a little confusing, and I have a sense that this makes it more confusing. Now, I represent a lot of constituents that are always griping about bicyclists, and I tell them, no, you know, stop that griping. It's an important thing. It's a great source of energy. But it just really, I don't know what to make of it, and maybe you can comment on this one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I guess what I can tell you is, again, you're going to have individuals that are bicyclists as well as motorists that are not going to obey the traffic control devices no matter what they are. And your example clearly shows that. Clearly, that individual should, in fact, have been cited for probably three, if not four, different things, depending on where it was in the city of Portland. If it was in the city of Portland, as to the restriction of bicycles being on sidewalks, some places they can. The definition, or I should say the rule in the traffic code, basically says that a bicycle is a vehicle. It has the right to a roadway, but it's supposed to ride as reasonably safe to the right as possible. And so technically you're not supposed to be riding down the middle of a lane of traffic if you can reasonably ride further or to the right and it's safe. My own practice is if I'm coming down a hill and I have a lot of intersections that are going to be coming down, I will probably move further into the right-of-way than I normally would ride, just because of the safety issues of having vehicles coming from the sides that may not see you. I know that from my own practice that if I'm on a straight line, it's much harder and difficult to see an individual that's traveling in a straight line as compared to if they're making any type of lateral movement, and you can visualize that. I think it comes back to identifying and recognizing that there is, in fact, a difference between the two. There is an education program that happens there. I'd give you an example which I think is unique. At least there's only maybe, well, Oregon is the only state I know of. I believe there may be one other state that provides for this. If you're in a vehicle, you may, in fact, make a left-hand turn onto a one-way street that's at a red light from a two-way. Most individuals, when we moved to Oregon in the mid-80s, I was reading through the vehicle code and said, huh, what's that? That's interesting. And the question would really come back, isn't that confusing for individuals that are also traveling down maybe on the one way and seeing a vehicle making a turn while they have a green light and apparently the car has a red light? It's education, and it's understanding of what the rules provide and enforcing them as they need to. But we have not changed that law because we have not found it to be a health risk or hazard. It's, again, the education and understanding the differences and your obligations as a cyclist or as a motor vehicle operator. You know, I operate both, and I think there is somewhat a difference between the two, and clearly everyone needs to comply with the law.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Would you suggest, as we replace stop signs, having a note, I mean, I'm sure we're not going to change every stop sign in the state, but as we replace them, having a note at the bottom that says accept bicycles or bicycles yield? I mean, would that, to help clarify that, so that it was...
I would say that is an option. Of course, the cost of doing that would be, I think, greater than most communities would want, and I don't think this actual committee or this body should actually be requiring that. There are some places in more, I want to say, bike-used areas, University of Oregon being in Eugene, you will see a number of traffic control signals that do give more clarity as to what and who can move through an intersection or what they can do. I would think that one thing you could actually have is some type of a decal that could be actually placed on the bottom of a stop sign that would, in fact, give that information, you know, except for bicycles yield, something like that. But it's possible. But we think that this is a change that is going to be ongoing, and that education will follow. And with groups such as BTA committed to safety and education in our communities on bicycle rules and how they intermesh with the other traffic, that this can be accomplished.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Representing his honor.
Mr. Chair, as I understand, we can't run a red light, a regular red light. You're not allowed to run that. It's that little flasher up there that and says a four-way stop, and then you make your right turn or left. Or
Mr. Chair, I represent his honor.
You're on that one, that's okay.
That is correct. If you, under this bill, if you approached a traffic control device, which was a red light type of signal, you would be required to stop, and then what you would be able to do, as vehicles are, you would be able to make the right or the left-hand turn, as we described, but you would need to come to that complete zero-mile stop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Byer.
I don't want you to think this is pick on your day.
Oh, that's what I
Tomorrow will be worse.
The thing that comes to my mind is your reducing the violation to a Class D and a smaller fine. And in my mind, I'm not sure whether the consequences are that much less for failure to yield, regardless of whether it's an automobile or a bicycle. And I kind of wonder about that. I mean, the consequences can be just as deadly, or maybe even more so, for a bicyclist that fails to yield.
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, that's correct. I would tell you that the bicyclist would be on the losing end of that in the sense of the hazard and the impact to them. But let me make it very clear. If this committee is favors passing this bill out and believes that the violation level should stay as a Class B versus a Class D, we will not oppose that change. We just felt that there was a recognition to be made as to the differences. Clearly, it was not our goal to, quote-unquote, lower the fine as a or pass this bill to somehow lower the fine. We just felt that there was a balancing test there, but clearly if this committee thinks that it should stay at the same level as for a motor vehicle as the sponsor of the bill, and I don't think that BTA would have any objection to that modification being made.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Looks like that's it. Thank you.
All righty. Thank you very much for hearing the bill. One other question.
Okay.
We did have one other individual, Scott Bricker, whose testimony I do believe you have. Mm-hmm. He's also with BTA. He said that he could make himself available at a later time if there was other questions and you had a work group, work session.
Okay.
Thank you,
Representative. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2768 and reopen the House bill hearing on House Bill 3001. Okay. All right. As Troy is coming up this morning, I'm the other sponsor on this bill. The other double fine safety corridor is in my district. It's a an area on Highway 18 and 22 that had the distinction of being written up in Reader's Digest as one of the most dangerous section of highway in the United States.
I drive it all the time.
And with that, good morning, Troy.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Not so sure I want that introduction. My name is Troy Casales. I am the manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And as Janet has stated, and Senator Metzger as well, already given you the purpose and reason for House Bill 3001. We have found that when safety corridors are put in place, if we work on those corridors from all three E's, the education, the enforcement, and the engineering points of view, they do make a difference. Very often in the first 2 to 3 years after a corridor has been identified, the crash rate for that corridor drops to the statewide average for the same type of road, if not even a little bit better. But it keeps the only way to keep that is to have due diligence. The double fines in the two safety corridors, we did conduct a study through Oregon State University and asked individuals about what they thought about the double fines. Did they know they were there? Did they seem to be effective? And the results were hit and miss. In part, I think, as Senator Metzger pointed out, the first couple years, the double fine was discretion of the court and not mandatory. And so in the last session, you all fixed that, which has also helped. And by extending this out, it's going to allow us to actually put in place some other types of tests, potentially looking at enforcement patterns, potentially looking at the way some of the education is done, and to also look and see, is there any other engineering improvements in those corridors that we need to do. The one question pointed, as Janet pointed out in the beginning, the one question we have of you, because it is not in statute, and from the very beginning it was just basically a legislative direction, not needing to be in the bill, do we retain these two corridors? Would you like us to shift to up to other corridors partly through the extension if the bill was to pass? That's really the only unanswered question in relationship to this bill. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be more than happy to try and answer any other questions.
Well, as this bill is written, would it permit you to ODOT to have other double fine areas then?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is it limits it to two. Two only, so we would not be able to identify any other new ones without taking out of the double fine classification the two that are currently there today.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you. Troy, I have a question regarding, since I wasn't here when the original legislation passed, what criteria were used in choosing the two safety corridors that were originally listed in the bill? And I think that would be helpful in figuring out whether to use the same criteria or look at other corridors.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dingfelder, the two chosen were at the direction of the House Transportation Committee Chair and Senate Committee Chair during the 99th session.
Mr. Chair, can I have a follow-up question?
Follow-up.
I won't ask if they happen to be in those districts, but I do know, I'm very familiar with the Highway 26 because I do travel that quite often, and I do agree with Senator Metzger that it's a very dangerous corridor, not to mention the road conditions, obviously, because there's often snow. Do you have a list? And what would be helpful, I think, for this committee is to look at the list of the most dangerous based on traffic fatalities in the state, and I certainly would be interested to see that.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dingfelder, what we look at two different things on the safety corridors, two ways that can trigger designating or actually decommissioning a corridor. That is the fatal and injury crash rate. So you're combining the injury crashes, the fatal crashes, based on the amount of travel, comparing that segment with the same type of roads all across the state. Is it above the average? And specific looking at the fatality rate based on miles traveled of that segment compared to other segments of its type around the state. When a roadway starts to exceed by more than 25% that particular rate, that's when it pops up and says we need to look at that. We do have for the current 13 corridors, we can provide the last 3 or 4 years of data, depending on when they came on board. Take a look at that and present that to you if you'd like to choose. I will say that the variability of the rate will bounce. In some cases, one fatal crash in an area will all of a sudden make it 200% of average. In the very next year or 2 years, like zero and zero and one again. And so because you're talking about such a small piece of road, the numbers bounce a lot. So, but we can provide that to you if you like for consideration in giving us direction on which two you'd like to designate, if different than the two today.
Thank you.
Well, with an amendment to this, this bill, we could increase it from two to a larger number, right?
I think, Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding, is that that you would have the ability to amend the bill to increase it to any number you so choose, all the way up to all 13 that are in existence today.
Yes, Janet.
And my only input is that in talking to legislative council, there's no requirement with extending the sunset of the bill we have now that ODOT would need to stick with the two they have, the two particular ones they have now, that it would still be up to the agency. And I understand that the agency last time took direction from the legislative committee, and that isn't anywhere in the bill, of course.
Okay. The how do you pick the other safety corridors?
Mr. Chairman, and similar to what I just described, Representative Dingfelder, looking at the fatal injury crash rate as well as the fatality rate, up until this last couple of years, it's been really reactive. Citizens or legislators have asked questions, and we've gone in and studied. It's in the last couple of years we've transitioned to be proactive and doing segment studies on the roads to see is there an emerging problem in certain areas of the state. And in some cases, we've decommissioned some of the corridors because they dropped below the average and there was no need to have them designated as a safety problem, and so they were decommissioned and the signs were taken down.
And so you don't have enough information or data right now to determine whether these should stay, these two should stay?
Mr. Chairman, I did not bring the corridor crash data table with me, but we do have something we can provide to you by the end of the week.
Yeah,
a couple of them, Troy. I'm a skier. Do most of the accidents occur during the wintertime and also in the afternoon when the skiers have hit the, you know, little bars after skiing and coming down, or do they? Because I don't want to impede my speed going up to the mountain, but I wouldn't mind slowing down when I come back. And I'm wondering maybe we put them on one side of the road or what. Any statistics on any of that stuff?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Zahn, we can get that. I don't have that off the top of my head to know if there's a specific there is a weather-related problem, but that corridor has problems all year round, not just during the winter. But I can't answer the question whether it's, you know, going east versus going west, which one is worse than the other.
How about use of alcohol for skiers coming down?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahn, that would be part of our data we could look to see and do have. What's the relative alcohol percentage?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Gillen.
I especially like you to also look at Crater Lake Highway while I'm sure you will, because it is a safety corridor already. We turn our lights on to go down it.
Any other questions?
Well, and I don't want to go over it. I'm trying to decide if this was answered, but it's at your discretion. If we were to extend the sunset, you could be switching corridors at any point during that five-year period. Is that right?
Ms. Chairman, Representative Byard, that appears to be correct, and it would be the department's discretion. However, corridor would not be identified as double flying unless all of the potential incoming areas of vehicles were signed to alert that you've entered into a zone that's double flying. We would need to educate and alert all law enforcement in the area and educate and train all the courts in the area as to what is going on. And so it's not something that's just done overnight.
Yeah, just clarify. And I didn't mean that, but I just meant this is a five-year period and things change. So during that five-year period, you don't have to come back to us to change it. You can just move it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Byer, that's my impression, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representing the
Would ODOT have the preference of being able to use this mechanism in any of the 13 safety corridors?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Greenlick, it is my understanding that we can designate any two of the 13 from this bill.
No, Mr. Chair, can I follow up?
Follow up.
No, I was asking the question, if there was an amendment, would ODOT favor having authority to use double finding in any of your 13, any number of your 13, or all of your 13?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, the double find, the extra signs that go in and the extra education that goes in, and usually just by community notice because someone's gotten an extra hefty charge, all lead to a heightened understanding that that's an area that they need to pay attention to and has a positive impact on safety. So extending it to more of them, we would have more impact on safety in more areas around the state.
Any other questions? Thank you, Joy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is it the committee's wish then we look at other areas then?
Yeah, I would suggest we authorize them, not force them, but authorize them to use this mechanism in any of the 13 safety corridors or any future safety corridors they identify.
Okay, well then we'd have to get some amendments drafted to do that. And. Okay. We'll close the public hearing and work on that in between.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would volunteer to get those amendments drafted, so it would be authority extended for 4 years beyond the current sunset date for any designated safety corridors for the department to choose to use the double fine.
Sure. I don't know what the thinking was when I originally felt to limit it to two then.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure how this goes. I'm not sure. I think legislators were a little bit concerned about the doubling fines because that does affect people negatively.
Okay, we get the amendments drafted, and then that, we'll have that discussion next time around, okay? We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3002. And Janet, can you give us a rundown on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3002 makes county service districts and cities that provide public transportation services eligible to receive monies from the state agency mass transit assessments. You'll recall we've already passed out of this committee House Bill 2035, which took care of an Lincoln County because they were formed under a different set of statutes. They everyone thought they were eligible for this mass transit assessment, and it turns out that they had never been eligible for it. And that bill took care of Lincoln County's problem and was retroactive so that Lincoln County could keep the money that they had already even spent and made them eligible for the mass transit assessments legally. So this bill does that same thing for county transit or county service districts, so it's compatible with the other bill you passed, and it makes that retroactive. It also would pick up cities, and that was not in the Lincoln County bill. It would pick up cities and make them eligible. Eligibility for city systems would begin under the bill January 1st, 2004, and again, the county ones would be retroactive. The state agency assessment program is established in Oregon statutes, and it's an in-lieu-of-taxes program to fund services of transit providers that they provide to state employees because state employees pay neither payroll tax or property taxes for state facilities within these transportation districts. And those are part of the ways of funding those districts that are not applicable when the property is owned by the state and the employees are state employees. We did talk about this, the districts that already get the transit assessment, including TriMet, Lane Transit, Salem Transit District, Rogue Valley, Basin Transit, South Clackamas, Hood River, Sunset Empire, Lincoln, and Tillamook, I'm not sure about Tillamook. I guess the Transit District, Division can answer that. But anyway, those already receive it. This would bring city providers in as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I have.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Roger Martin, Justin Roach, and Steve? So I get that right, Roof? Rogers? All right, Steve Rogers?
Did you see
that? Oh, I see. That's a G down.
When is it retroactive? The date on the summary sheet is wrong.
26?
Is it?
25?
Oh, that's a...
19.
That's a big number.
Yeah. What's the...
1996.
We'll start with you, Roger. If you'd like.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Transit Association. I signed up last so I could testify last, and here I am first. Just a brief history. We've covered some of this before. In the early 1970s, TriMet and Lane Transit were given the authority as transit districts to levy a payroll tax. And other districts levied other kinds of revenue measures to support the operation of those transit systems. In 1981, then Governor Attia said, you know, if you realize that half of the people or more in some instances that ride bus systems are public employees, we ought to be somehow having those employers for cities, counties, the state, school districts helping to support that. And he instituted what was known as the in lieu of payroll tax, where the state pays as a portion of their, they pay a similar amount of money to whatever the local levy is on private businesses. It has worked well everywhere, and as Janet pointed out, cities were not included because at that time the city of Woodburn, which has always been in the bus business, the city of Corvallis, which has historically been in the bus business, did not have a separate levy. They just simply funded what they were doing out of the general fund of that city. In the ensuing time, City of Corvallis and others, as you'll hear, have passed special levies, but they don't qualify. And as a lifelong duck, it gives me great pleasure to point out that the University of Oregon has been supporting Lane Transit to the tune of about $1 million a year for a number of years. Portland State has been doing the same, but the Oregon State University has not. Even though we've been here several times to ask for that authority, and I think it ought to be fair that all the institutions do the same thing.
Thank you.
Oh, yes, you did.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Rogers. I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Corvallis, and I thank you for this opportunity. Unfortunately, our mayor, Mayor Helen Berg, would really like to be here today, but she had a legislative committee of her own to deal with this morning, and she, although wanted to be here, chose to stay in Corvallis this morning. We do request your support of this bill. As you have heard, transit service in Oregon is provided through a number of different ways. One is transit districts, mass transit districts, and cities. And some of the cities that provide transit service that are not districts include Albany, Corvallis, Philomath, Lebanon, Wilsonville, Bend, Woodburn, and several others. In fact, I read an article in the newspaper yesterday that said that the city of Ontario was looking at ceasing their transit system because of financial difficulties. All of these agencies, districts and cities, provide bus service to the general public, and yet cities are treated differently by the state. Only mass transit districts and transportation districts are eligible to receive compensation for the transit service they provide to state agencies. Currently, ORS 291.405 provides transit funding to mass transit districts and transportation districts through an assessment on state payroll within the area served by transit. It is built into the state agency's payroll expense. It was put in place by the legislature, as you heard, years ago to compensate transit providers for the transit service that state agencies receive. Unfortunately, at the time the assessment was created, only mass transit districts and transportation districts were recognized as transit providers. Therefore, the transit service districts, or the transit districts, receive state funding and are able to provide a higher level of transit service than non-districts can provide. Additionally, state agencies paying the assessment are exempt from any city parking code requirements for state buildings in the transit service area, and I think this is part of the existing bill that is usually forgotten, but could be very important to agencies such as Oregon State University. The proposed legislation, House Bill 3002, would amend the law to create equality among all the governing bodies providing transit service to state agencies to the extent that the local communities support transit service. Which means that the local agency, local community, must also provide at least half the cost of that service. And in Corvallis, we have historically, since 1981, had a three-year serial levy that was solely provided to support transit service. With Measure 47 and 50, that actually went away and became part of the city rate, the total city rate. And so the city still does support through property tax the most of the cost of the system in Corvallis. Corvallis has been directly serving state facilities, including Oregon State University, with transit service in Corvallis since 1981, and yet it received no state compensation for this service. By contrast, as you've already heard, Lane Transit District, which serves U of O, receives about $1 million a year from the state to pay for their transit system. In no way do I mean to indicate that Lane Transit District service is as small as the Corvallis service area or that the Corvallis service area should provide the same level of service. However, we could do better and we should do better in Corvallis. There are regional issues also. Lane Transit District provides a regional system. Although the Corvallis system does not, it does, through partnerships, provide regional systems. In the Corvallis area, there's Corvallis-Albany Transit System, the Lynn Benton Loop system, and Philomath. Those are four different systems that together provide regional service, much as the larger mass transit districts do. As a matter of fact, Corvallis manages the Philomath system for them, and Albany manages the Loop system. So really there's only two people managing for the four systems. The Lynn Benton Loop provides a huge economic benefit to OSU, since many lower division classes do not have to be offered at OSU, and that is the importance of the Loop system to actually transfer students from Lynn Benton to Oregon State and back. The city of Corvallis supports the Loop through funding, as does Albany and Oregon State University and Lynn Benton Community College. So passage of this bill would benefit regional transportation services. We operate the transit service through the city because we believe that in our region it is most efficient, the most efficient means to provide the service. Because we operate the service, we do not have to have the additional administrative expenses associated with the formation and operation of a separate mass transit or transportation district. And partly because of that, we operate one of the lowest cost per rides services in the state, and we also compare favorably with the larger transit providers in the number of rides per hour of service that we operate. The proposed legislation would provide equity for transit providers and result in equity for the state facilities served by transit. We ask for your support of this bill. Thank you.
Representative Mabry. Mr. Rogers, earlier on in your testimony, you talked about an exemption from parking regulation, and that went right over my head. I don't understand. Could you explain that a little bit better for me?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mabry, the bill actually says that in this situation where the state agency pays a portion of the transit service cost, then that state agency is not subject to the local jurisdiction parking requirements. So, for example, at OSU, when there is a building built, then they go through the normal Corvallis planning system, and there is a parking requirement of some kind. I can't tell you specifically what it might be, but there would be a parking requirement of some kind. If this bill was passed, then there would be no parking requirements put on OSU by the city of Corvallis per the bill.
Mr. Chairman, may I help answer that question to Representative Mabry? In the early 80s, the state of Oregon was under the gun to build more parking for this state capital, and there was a plan that would tear up the entire park between here and the river. I mentioned this earlier. Go underground and build a similar structure to what we have out here and tear down all those trees and everything else. The Capital Planning Commission went bonkers. They just couldn't believe we'd endanger the park out here. So a negotiation was put in force, and this provision was put into the law that if the state of Oregon helped Salem Area Transit transport state workers, and there's been an ongoing process ever since to try to get as many Capital Mall workers to use the bus system, we didn't have to build that parking structure. And the same would be true, as Mr. Rogers pointed out, for Oregon State University, and I think the same is true right now at Portland State, who have very limited land in which to build parking.
Thank you.
It's a good provision that I'm sure that someday might even come to the Dalles.
Well, I don't know about that, but I totally didn't understand it. Thank you. That very clearly clarifies it.
Janet, you have a question?
Yeah, and that you can. That's on page 3 of the bill.
Section 6.
Subsection 6, starting on line 12 of page 3.
It's in there now, actually.
It's existing.
It's existing
law, and it would make cities eligible as mass transit districts are.
Representative Greenland.
Yes, I'm not sure who to ask this question to, and it was probably with Mr. Martin, but it might be the LC. I've seen a lot of bills where we've substituted may for shall. Shall meaning a requirement, may meaning authorization. In this case, we've substituted may not for shall not. And in both line 36 and in the next section as well. Was this simply a change in syntax that the LC is doing now, or was it intended to do something? Is may not intended to be any different than shall not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, there is no there. It's just a cleanup that they're doing. Whenever they get into a open up a statute for something else, they go through and do this.
But the question of may not has the same force as shall. One,
yes,
it removes the authorization, whereas shall not removes the requirement. This removes the authorization that may would bring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, there is a difference if it's in the positive. They shall is different than they may.
They may, that's right. One's a requirement, the other's an authorization.
Right, but in the negative, there is no difference between shall not and may not.
So it takes away the authorization as opposed to taking away the requirement.
Mr. Chair.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I just wanted to make sure that this wasn't a substantive change, sure. Simply a change. In
the whole last session, as I remember, we went through this may and shall type thing, and they never did get it solved. And one would say may is more important, the other would say shall, and they tried to clean it up in the last session.
May and shall are very different. Yeah. But what I think is may not and shall not are exactly the same, and I would just check that.
Yeah. That's my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
But it may change next week.
You didn't have any comment on
that. I was a history major, not an English major. I'm sorry.
Mr. Roach, would you like to give your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Justin Roach, and I am a Corral City Councilor, and thank you for your time this morning. As Director Rogers has stated, Corral citizens have had a long history of supporting transit through financial support, citizen usage of the transit system, and implementation of policies and programs to encourage the use of alternative transportation modes. Demand for transit service in Corvallis has quadrupled over the last 20 years, reaching over 500,000 rides in the last year. Oregon State University ridership makes up over 43% of the rides on the Corvallis transit system and over 60% on the Philomath connection. The Oregon State University campus receives a significant amount of transit service provided by the city of Corvallis. However, the lack of frequency and later operating hours deters many staff and students from using transit services. OSU students who are unable to live on campus are unable to reach the OSU library and other resources on campus in the evening hours because of limited transit service hours. This has long been an issue with students who are trying to find affordable housing, which is farther away from campus. The demand for service on the Corvallis and Philomath transit system outweighs the ability for the two cities to provide the service needed because of competing budget priorities. Transit districts around the state are better able to meet this demand because of the payments made by those state agencies who receive transit service and compensate districts for the service. It has already been noted that the transit districts and cities providing transit service are not treated equitably for the transit services they provide to state agencies. There is another equity issue which I would like to address. The city's transit system is primarily funded approximately 78% by local taxpayers. Privately owned businesses such as the Hewlett-Packard, CH2M Hill, Evanite, and the Corvallis Clinic pay property taxes to the city for transit service. As already stated, Corvallis receives no state funding for the transit service provided to state agencies. To make the situation even more inequitable, many of these private businesses receive a lower level of service than state agencies in Corvallis. If House Bill 3002 is approved, the state would pay its share of local transit service provided by cities and still have an advantage over private businesses paying local taxes. And as pertaining to Representative Mabry's question, state agencies would be exempt from parking code requirements in exchange for their assessment. This provision would be particularly beneficial to the state and to Oregon State University. OSU currently is required by the Corvallis Land Development Code to comply with specific requirements when any proposed development results in traffic and or parking impacts. One example of savings, which could have occurred if Oregon State was not subject to the city's parking requirements, is the construction of the OSU Alumni Center. OSU was required to construct 161 parking spaces as part of the center's development. The cost to construct a surface parking space is approximately $5,000 to $7,000 per space. that cost increases between $15,000 and $25,000 for a parking structure. The parking construction cost for 161 parking spaces on a surface lot alone amounts between $805,000 and $1,127,000. If a parking structure had been built, these costs would have increased to between $2,415,000 and $4,025,000. These parking spaces must also be maintained, and the land cannot be used for any other purpose, i.e. another building project. The City of Corvallis would like to partner with the State of Oregon, as it is with its individual and business taxpayers, taxpaying partners, in addressing the transportation needs of its state agencies and citizens through compensation for a transit service that it receives. Thank you on behalf of the City of Corvallis for your time today and your serious consideration of House Bill 3002.
Thank you, Mr. Roach. Any questions? Representative's honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it about money? I mean, where's the money going to come from? You're partnering with the state. You want to get some of our money from the state? Or, I mean, there's got to be some money here somewhere, isn't it? I'm trying to get a handle on it. Roger?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zoner, the money, it won't come out. It is a payroll tax that Oregon State University and other state agencies that operate in Corvallis would have to pay as part of their payroll. So, yeah, it would affect the budget of Oregon State or Oregon State University. They'll have to pay whatever the rate is set at. But it's not a general fund appropriation. It's part of their budget.
Will Oregon State be opposed to this, the university, or how do they feel?
I wouldn't hazard a guess.
Oh, okay.
I think that... You know, if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck, it is a duck. Another
or a beaver.
Yeah.
Another transit districts and entities within the state benefit from this payroll tax. But having said that, this does have a big time impact on general fund revenues, and it does have a referral to Ways and Means.
Oh.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Could we have Martin Loring and David Barenberg?
Quacks like a beaver.
Quacks like a beaver.
Hey, it could happen in today's society.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members, staff. My name is Martin Loring. I'm the administrator of the Public Transit Division within the Oregon Department of Transportation. Most of what I plan to say has been ably covered by the people who have testified ahead of me. I'd like to just touch on a couple of facts and then close with what I think is the most important fact. Your administrator, Janet Atkins, accurately described the 10 districts that have received these in lieu of tax payments through the Mass Transit assessment program since 1981 when the program was created. Mr. Rogers mentioned most of the cities that quite possibly could be eligible to receive assessment payments if 3002 were to become law. There are a total of 16 municipal corporations or cities in the state of Oregon that deliver some sort of general public transportation service, bus service, in the state today. The crux issue in this bill for this committee is, as a number of people have said, is a fundamental fairness issue. The Mass Transit Assessment Program was created so the state can recognize the benefit that it receives when a bus is available to take their workers to and from the job. And those services are supported with local taxes, by and large, that the state does not pay, and this program was created to recognize that benefit, compensate for the value received. The 16 cities that currently provide bus service to the general public deliver the same benefit to the state in proportion to the number of state employees that actually do work in that city. And so the core issue of this bill is an equity issue. and I thank you for the opportunity to testify. The assessment rate is left in the current law to the discretion of the Department of Administrative Services, but may not exceed 0.6% of the state payroll for workers delivering service in the eligible jurisdiction. I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Martin. David.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. To begin my testimony with an apology, and the apology is that I'm not Andrea Fogue, who is... I thought I could try to look like her, but I thought, no, I better stay away. And she's off at the Transportation Commission testifying on the scintillating issue of bypass policy at the moment. Just to briefly on 3002, I just wanted to voice the league's support. Through in life, I've been told that there is no such thing as a free lunch, but in this case, there appears to be a such thing as a free ride, which state agencies have been able to get just by reason of bureaucratic and administrative structure, not by policy. And I think what this bill just tries to do, or what does, is to clarify, or not to clarify, to really clear up just a structural anomaly, whereas, as Martin and others have said, that just by reason of structure and how you're structure you use to provide the service that makes you ineligible for funding that is was approved and was initiated to meet the purpose of public transit needs. So I think that this bill really just continues the state's policy and really will keep from penalizing agencies like the city of Corvallis, which rather than set up a new administrative or bureaucratic structure just to qualify for funding, utilizes the most effective and efficient ways of delivering the service, and they shouldn't be penalized for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Could either one of you tell me what percent do they, the districts that are now eligible for it, are they up to the max 0.6%?
Mr. Chair, they DAS has in fact been using the 0.6% assessment rate, with one exception. Under the current law, state employees paid with federal funds are not charged. So it's 0.6% of state employees delivering service within an eligible district that are paid with other funds or general fund revenues.
Okay, so there isn't one district that's at 0.3 and another district at 0.6.
No, DAS deals with all of the eligible jurisdictions in exactly the same way.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3002, and might as well send it on its way. Open the work session on House Bill 3002. There is a referral to Ways and Means, and I'd entertain a motion to send it on its way.
Mr. Chair, I move that we actually pass House Bill 3002, or do we refer it directly to the committee? It has to pass out of here first,
right.
Correct?
Okay.
Yeah.
I move that we pass House Bill 3002 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dingfelder moves that we pass House Bill 3002 with a referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Ryan, will you call the roll?
Representative Gilman.
Yes.
Representative Greenleg.
Excuse.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Okay, now we do the other one. Open a public hearing on House Bill and possible reconsideration on House Bill 2997. And committee, we failed to do something right, and so now we're going to try to straighten it out.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2997.
Representative Beyer moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2997. Jen, I'll let you explain the reason.
Okay. Mr. Chair, on Friday, the committee passed House Bill 2997 to the floor as amended, and it had a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee, so that was mistake on my part. The revenue staff and the revenue chair have indicated they do not need to review this bill in their committee, that it can go straight to the floor. So the bill, because the bill has no revenue impact. This was a bill related to cardlock charging for fuel at cardlocks. The purpose is to bring the bill back to rescind the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. So
are there any objections to Representative Byers' motion to suspend the rules? If not, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2997.
Representative Byers moves we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2997. Are there any objections? If not, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2997 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee be rescinded.
Representative Beyer moves that House Bill 2997 moves House Bill 2997 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion? Ryan, will you please call the roll?
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative
Zahner.
Aye.
Representative
Byer.
Aye.
Representative
Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. And did we have to redo that? Yeah. Is there a motion to place this on the consent calendar?
I move we place 2997 on the consent calendar.
Representative Greenlech moves that we place 2997 on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Motion carried. Pardon?
Can I say something?
Certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify a question that Representative Greenlech asked during this discussion on House Bill 2997 about when the diesel tax was collected. I answered the question incorrectly. I answered the question correctly if you'd been talking about gasoline, but this bill and your question was about the diesel tax. So I'm going to read what the Department of Transportation would have said if I had let them answer instead. gasoline is taxed at the distributor level, but everyone pays down the chain through the gasoline tax, and that's kind of the answer I gave on the diesel. But diesel is taxable when the fuel is physically placed in the fuel tank of the motor vehicle that's going to use it. So existing law requires the seller to either charge the tax or document why the fuel is not taxable at the point it's delivered into the fuel tank. And so House Bill 2997 dealt with cardlocks because the AG said they have to collect at the pump. They don't collect at the pump. They collect through a billing process instead. So that was the reason for 2997. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2853. And we have some amendments, Janet. Can you tell us what they do?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was the bill that House Bill 2853 that allowed transportation districts to limit the terms of certain members next elected to their boards in order to stagger the future election of members, stagger the terms. Again, this deals with the Tillamook County Transportation District that, when it was formed in 97, had all of the members elected at the same date for the four-year term. The statute didn't provide for taking care of this retroactively, so the amendment is needed. It's a temporary change. Would allow the district at the next election to elect new board members to shorter terms, three of the board members to shorter terms. And then after that, the terms would be staggered. You have at your place a -2 amendment. The amendments were not ready at the last meeting, and in the meantime, they also needed to be changed. We did, the last thing that's stapled in your packet this morning for this bill is a hand-engrossed version of the bill that shows the changes that the -2 amendments make. There's no change in intent here, but just the language, to clarify the language. So also at the 2005 election, the transit board will elect all its members, but three of them will only be elected to two-year terms, and from then on they'll be staggered. The elections will be staggered.
How are they going to select those two or three to flip a coin? Or?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that the board has already had some volunteers.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Janet.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if they're elected by district, but it does say that the second, fourth, and sixth member of the governing body shall serve a term. I don't know if the positions are numbered or not, but that may be already decided by the bill.
Okay. Thank you again. Let's see. I need a motion to...
Mr. Chair, I'd like to motion to move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2853.
Did we adopt the one first?
Mr. Chair, we talked about the dash ones, but we didn't have them in hand, and they were not adopted because we didn't have them. So there was no work on this bill at the first meeting. So we can just start with the dash twos.
Representative Donner moves that we adopt the dash two amendments to 2853. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Dash two are adopted. Yeah, I mean, we need to adopt the dash ones.
No.
Don't we got them both on one fell swoop?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the dash ones were not what the district wanted.
Okay, so the dash twos take care of it.
Yes.
Okay, I need another motion to.
Mr. Chair, I'd just love to move House Bill 2853 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Zahner moves House Bill 2853. As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Could I have a motion to put this on the consent calendar?
Mr. Chair, I move that we place 2853
as consent calendar.
Representative Byer moves that 2853 as amended be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Hearing none. Well done. The chair would move that the move. All right, tell me what I do. This is the Representative Greenlee can vote.
Suspend the rules.
The chair would move that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Greenlee to vote on House Bill 3002. Is there any objection? Seeing none. Representative Greenlee, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Representative Greenlee votes aye. Well, we need now a motion carried, I guess. Mm-hmm. Motion carried, House Bill 3002. I must have left something out somewhere. But
no, that's all.
Okay. is there any other, anything else for the committee this morning? Nothing. We are adjourned.